Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. And for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options and making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And you can all do me a huge favor. Please forward at least one of our shows to your social media groups or to someone you know that can benefit from a particular show. And we try to make each show a particular topic, and I think all of us know somebody that can benefit from each topic each week. Now, I just want you to know that Answers for the Family will still continue to address a variety of topics, including locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. And we'll introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and fun for you and your family. And speaking of fun, now, who out there, and maybe those closer to my age, remember the magazine called Highlights from when they were a kid? Well, our show's ambassador to kindness, Gabriella Von Rey, and Highlights, they want all kids to be kind to others, and in doing so, to change the world for the better. So, in honor of Random Act of Kindness Week, we are sharing their recent State of the Kid survey, which contains heartwarming insight on how kids view kindness and empathy, along with helpful parenting takeaways. Now, you can read it by going to www.highlights.com/State of the Kid. So that's STATEOVTHEKID. It will be well worth it to sit down and share that with your children. Now, our topic today is something on the other end of the scale. It's life's last gift, giving and receiving peace when a loved one is dying. Now, our guest is Dr. Charles Garfield, and he is a psychologist, author, and founder of the Shanty Project, a widely acclaimed AIDS and cancer service organization. And Dr. Garfield is a clinical professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California School of Medicine at San Francisco, and has been for nearly four decades. And he is a fellow of the American Psychological Association. Now, he is currently a research scholar at the Starr King School for the Ministry at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Charles, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the kind invitation.
Well, you're very welcome. And I think as we were discussing a little bit before we went on the air, this is a difficult subject for me. And I want to put it out there. And, you know, if it's showing a little bit of vulnerability, that's okay. The time to talk to someone when you know that they are getting towards the end, it's not something that I think is comfortable for most people. I know it's not for me. And in the same sense, neither is talking to those that after the person has passed, those loved ones that are close to them, and being able to determine when is a good time to talk to them, when isn't, when are they grieving, would they rather you didn't bring it up? I think there's so many questions. And I think that, you know, fortunately, you've taken the time to put together the book that allows us to really go and get some of those answers. So, but I think to start off with, so when a person is dying, I think the impulse of many loved ones is always to do something, but explain why simply being present and open is sometimes the most important thing a loved one can do.
Well, what we've learned over the last 40 years is that the experience of being cared for, benefits the person dying more than anything that you say or do. Just the fact that you're there, you're willing to listen, you're willing to ask a few questions from time to time, and that you're not afraid to be there, that you're with them. I took care of my mother, my father, and my closest friend when they were in their dying times. And all three of them, plus so many hundreds of other people, reinforced over and over again that the fact that I was willing to show up, pay attention, and care was more important than any specific thing I said or did. So I think it's important that we understand that our showing up and being there and caring is enough. That's our gift to the people we love most.
Well, and I think it is. It's a great gift. It sounds like you're also saying that, I think oftentimes for those of us that are always trying to help, there's a helpless feeling that we're having when we are with that person. Are you saying don't show that, or it's okay to show that because they understand?
It's always okay to say that you love somebody, and the fact that you're there and you're feeling helpless. I've said to so many people over the years that I wish I could make it all go away, that I wish that I had the power to change things and to take away the suffering and take away the pain. But in fact, I can't. But what I can do is be there and share it and listen to people's stories and listen to their feelings and ask a few questions from time to time. You don't have to have the right answers. In fact, nobody has the right answers to all sorts of questions. But you can ask questions like,
sure,
what's the best thing for me to do today? Or is there anything that your doctor can do that he or she is not doing? Just to ask common sense questions that indicate to the person that you're with them.
Yeah, I know in the book you stress a lot about listening from the heart, and I know that you list an exercise to help. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The one thing that you can do that's more important than anything else is to listen deeply from the heart to the people that you're caring for, and it's as if you're making everything they say your focus. A lot of times when we meet with people and in normal daily life, we sort of listen, but we're mostly thinking our own thoughts and wondering about all sorts of other things. And people know when you're not listening to them. They know when you're not really paying attention. 70% to 90% of the information we send to one another in life is communicated nonverbally.
Mm-hmm.
It's the way we look. It's the tone of our voice. It's the way our eyes dart around the room instead of really paying attention. So listening from the heart, really, really paying attention, is the single most important gift you can give people.
Now, Charles, I'm one of those that's a firm believer of breathing in positive things. In other words, I don't want a doctor that gives doom and gloom. And, you know, and there's hundreds of stories out there that I've heard of a doctor that tells somebody, well, you know, you've only got 6 weeks to live, and they die in 6 weeks. So for those of us that really believe that we don't want to breathe in or we don't want them to breathe in any of that negativity, how do you suggest we handle hope and yet not provide a false hope?
I think the most important thing about hope is what people are hopeful for. And nobody has a precise estimate that tells the person exactly when it's all going to be over and when they're going to die. When a person is in hospice, for instance, what it means is the doctor has estimated that there's approximately 6 months left in their life. But that doesn't always happen. And in fact, all sorts of people outlive the prognosis.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to buy into any precise estimates. You can say that people are unique And in fact, things can work out differently than anything that the doctor says that's extremely precise. Most good physicians nowadays will only give rough, very rough estimates, and they won't come out with very, very strong statements about you will live a certain amount of time. In fact, that can be cruel.
Right.
You can say that I would guess that when my father was dying, he was told he had approximately 3 to 6 months. But his doctor said he's been surprised many times by people who outlive the prognosis, and that may happen with you too, he said to my father, which was a wonderful way of saying it. He actually outlived the prognosis by quite a bit. So, hope is critical. Being positive is a wonderful attribute. And you don't want to, but the greatest cruelty you can offer is to lie to somebody. That, in fact, you don't want to say something that's patently not true. They know that they're ill. They feel it in their bodies. They feel worse than they've ever felt in their lives. You know, when you're dying of an illness, it hurts. It doesn't feel good. And people want to know at least some of the truth of what's going on for them. And to be available to them in communicating that truth is an act of compassion.
Right. So what I hear you saying is that give hope, be there, help provide hope, but don't provide false hope. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Right. That's exactly what I'm saying. False hope is another way of saying lying.
Yeah.
And that's a cruel thing to do, especially to a vulnerable person.
Right. No, I get it. Now, I think that there's many different types of people that go through things, and the person who is reaching the end of their time, I think oftentimes from a personality standpoint, they deal with it very differently. And I had someone tell me a story of their parent that when it became those last days, and actually as they kind of over a period of a year or so, they became not a very nice person during that time. So how would you counsel people who are coming to their dying loved one who maybe has become or has had a history of anger, abuse, mistreatment, or resentment? Is it possible for these people to give and receive peace and comfort at that time?
Yeah, it is, although it can be difficult. And in fact, forgiveness is one of the key one of the most important things that we face when we're taking care of somebody who's not treated us particularly well. Is there a way to forgive them and understand that they're going through life's most difficult challenge, and to realize that the challenge itself is causing them to become, shall we say, less than their best selves? I've worked with people who aren't very nice and who were very demanding or angry. It's important to remember that anger is the only emotion strong enough to ward off the fear. It's the only emotion. When we're angry, we feel strong. It may not be pleasant interpersonally, but we feel strong. Often people who are angry are doing so because they're trying to wall off the fear that they're experiencing. If we understand that a lot of that anger is not directed at us personally, even though it sounds like it might be, but rather is an attempt to deal with the fear of the situation, you can develop a lot more compassionate attitude toward that individual.
I think that's such a great point, and I know that it's something that we talk about when we're working with at-risk youth and they're lashing out at what's happening, or they're lashing out at us, or they're lashing out at their parents. And we try to explain to the parents that's the fear of the unknown that child is lashing out at them, so that the parents don't take it so hard, but I think that's a great point. Is it's the same thing. I mean, there's this incredible fear of the unknown as they're going through this process. I think we all mask it in different ways. And I think that's a great way that you've explained it, because it allows us to sit back and not take it personally when they're lashing out with anger.
Exactly. You know, and when you think about it, 650,000 people die in the U.S. every year, 650,000. And 90% of Americans believe that it's the family's responsibility to care for those folks. And yet, we have no user-friendly resources available. That's why I wrote Life's Last Gift, to allow people a user-friendly resource to, so that they'd know how to care for people. We have more books on how to play golf and how to fix your car than we do how to take care of your loved ones during their most vulnerable time. And so, you know, just a few tips, like understanding that anger and aggression can be motivated by fear more than anything else. Just a few tips like that can be worth their weight in gold when you're really up against it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think empathy is another thing that falls into that category. And I know that it's such a vital component of our relationship with our dying loved one. But then I think we all know it can be extremely taxing. So can you tell us how we can keep our empathy strong and sincere without really depleting our own resources?
Well, first, it's important to understand what empathy is. And I think many people do, but it's worth repeating.
Sure.
Empathy is an imaginative entrance into the other person's situation, into the world of another person. It's imagining yourself in their situation and asking yourself, what would it be like for me if I were in that situation?
Mm-hmm.
That's where the kindness comes from. That's where the empathy comes from, realizing just how challenging that person's situation really is. And then you're asking a very important question, which is, how do we maintain the empathy when it can be a challenge to do so, especially over many months and sometimes even years? And some, you know, when we talk about somebody dying, we don't mean in 3 days. Often we're talking about many, many months.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we're talking about years of a life-threatening illness playing out. How can we maintain that kind of empathy? Understand, simply put, that self-compassion is just as important an ingredient as compassion for the other person. Being compassionate for yourself. And I know that when I work with people at the end of life, I can be fully present with them when I'm with them. But when I leave, I leave and I go on with my life. And I may think about them, and I certainly care about them, but it's okay for me to take care of myself when I leave them, that I'll do something especially nice for myself if it's taxing. If it's somebody I'm very close to, and I feel all sorts of grief-related feelings, I'll treat myself to something particularly nice when I leave, just to ease the burden somewhat. So the real key is to learn how to be with somebody, and when you leave, you leave.
See, I think that's a great point. And as you started to explain that, one of the first things that you mentioned in talking about empathy was talking about kindness. And I know in the book, you talk about just small acts of kindness. So share with us, you know, why these small acts of kindness are so incredibly important to a dying person.
Well, yeah, it really is a critical thing. And it sounds like a throwaway issue that people just won't pay attention to. But it turns out that small acts of kindness can mean everything. One of the things that my mother enjoyed most was a particular kind of ice cream pop. And every time I went to see her, I had a box of those ice cream pops. And you could see her face light up when she saw them. She not only wanted it for herself, she wanted those pops to be able to give to the nurses, to the doctors, to other patients. She just wanted to give them away and treat people kindly. That little thing, that seemingly little thing, meant the world to her. What small act of kindness can you offer your loved one that will really light them up, something that they may have appreciated their whole lives? Another thing I did for my mother that I thought was very useful, she certainly said so,
mm-hmm.
was I made small photo albums. I got all those old photos that are lying around. And we talked about all sorts of people in those photos, and she loved those sessions we had reviewing the photo albums and remembering all those times in her past.
You know, and that's a great point when you bring up in regards to talking about those, because you mentioned in the book that listening to the loved one's stories can be a very powerful aspect of their dying process. How can we learn to heighten this experience for them?
Well, to recognize the fact that the stories are their legacy. It's what they're leaving behind. It's what they're offering those people who are the survivors. If you're at the bedside of a loved one who's dying and they start telling you all these stories, it's not that they're rambling and they're just telling you incidental things. Those are really important. It's their legacy. It's what's called life review. They're going over their lives and telling you the stories that meant the most to them. It's important to pay attention to those stories, and especially to let people know that you really value the stories and that you'll remember them. And that if there are lessons in those stories, that you'll take them seriously in your own life. It's a way of telling them that you'll walk in the world for them after they're gone. So listening to those people's stories really is a critical thing. That's why we emphasize it a lot in the book, because it's a really critical part of caring for somebody at the end of life.
You know, I love that, because what I see it also as is, you know, it's, excuse me, it's passing the legacy on. If you're listening and they know that you're taking it to heart, if you're explaining to them, you know, and I'm going to share this with my children, you know, and they're going to share it with their children and so on and so on. Excuse me. I think that's powerful for them. That's that feeling of carrying on forever.
Yeah, I sometimes call it an immortality project.
Yeah.
The way that a certain kind of immortality, that they can live on past their days, because there's something in their lives that you take seriously. A story, a lesson, something that was important to them, and that they're handing to you as a gift. And that's essentially why we call it the book Life's Last Gift, because it's essentially about giving gifts one to the other. The dying person is giving you a gift as well,
mm-hmm.
by telling you what mattered most in their lives and giving you that as a gift.
And I know one of the things in the book, and again, for everybody out there, if you get a chance to read the book, I mean, it's something that we're all going to go through with a loved one. And I just found it incredibly heartwarming as far as a read. But I know that you put stories in there. And if you could share a couple of stories with our listeners, I think that would be great.
Well, one was caring for my father when he was dying. I was in my 40s at the time, and I was going to find a solution. I didn't want to accept the fact that he was dying, and I was reading about all sorts of new treatments, and I was asking all sorts of doctor friends about what we might do that his doctor wasn't doing. I thought I was going to be a hero, that I was going to find something that was really going to save him. And one day when I was in his house, and I was talking to him about all the research I had done, he looked at me with this kind look on his face, and he said, "Charlie, I love you, and I wish you would stop running around and just spend time with me. I know I don't have a lot of time left. I believe my doctors when they say that there's not a lot of time, and that I don't want to waste it running around looking for cures that are simply not going to turn up anything positive." And I realized in that moment, just in that moment, by the look on his face, that what he wanted most was me. That mm-hmm. he didn't want me running around not being with him. He wanted me to come visit more often and to talk and to listen to his history and to listen to his stories. And that was a very, very important lesson for me, that you feel like being a hero and solving it all. And doing some of that, I suppose, makes sense. It's hard to resist it. But don't let the running around prevent you from being with the person in a loving fashion.
Wow. You just really hit home for me, because I'm in the running around stage right now. That really hit home. So now that we're making this choice and we're spending more time with them, and I guess we can probably, you know, research things and stuff while we're with them as well as we can, you know, running around away from them. How can we emphasize, you know, to our dying loved one that we will accompany them as far as we can go together?
Well, you know, that's one of the keys. People are afraid that loved ones will get too intimidated by the situation and that they'll stop visiting and they'll simply leave. They just won't. At the time in which it gets most frightening, as things approach the end, that nobody will be there. It's important to let people know that you're going to accompany them on this journey as far as you can go together. It's like holding somebody's hand and walking across a bridge. Mm-hmm. And you can go halfway across, three quarters of the way across, but at some point you let go of their hand and they have to continue and you can't follow.
Right.
It's important to let them know that you will be there no matter what happens, that you're going to share the journey with them. And that expression of love can actually heal. It doesn't always cure. There's a difference between curing and healing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you can't cure them physically, but you can heal them spiritually and emotionally and interpersonally. That love, that kind of expression of love, that you'll be with them as far as you can go together, can actually make them feel a whole lot better knowing that you mean it, that you're serious about it.
Wow. Okay, so for everybody out there, our guest is Dr. Charles Garfield, and the book is Life's Last Gift: Giving and Receiving Peace When a Loved One is Dying. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest is Dr. Charles Garfield. And if you would like to learn more about his book or learn more about Dr. Garfield, you can go to his website at www.charlesgarfield.com. And you all know, if you're driving out there, you can't write this down, you can always go to answersforthefamily.com and all of Dr. Garfield's information will be right there. So Charles, we have some questions that have come in, and this one reads, my grandfather was diagnosed with advanced pancreatic cancer 7 months ago. Most of the family have been very helpful during his decline, but I was surprised that my two sisters are avoiding visiting or being involved in any way. Can you give me some advice on how to approach them so that they will not feel that I am being judgmental by gifting them your book? This is from Beth in Washington.
I think that the simplest way to approach it is to say that this book has been very helpful to you. And what I'd say to the person who suggested that question is that offer to your sisters a book, Life's Last Gift, that's been very helpful to you and that you think may be helpful to them as well. And let them know that you're not judging them. This is not a judgment about anything, but just that the book is a book about relationships, especially relationships at the end of life, and that grandpa could benefit from as much kindness as possible during this period, and we all can play our part. You don't have to be judgmental about it at all. It's just it's a gift to your sisters who evidently need the assistance, as many of us do, and I would just offer it in that spirit.
All right. Well, that brings another question, and it's similar in the sense. Now, if you have a similar situation, but yet the dying grandparent in this case doesn't want people to see them, they get to a stage in which they say, I don't want people to remember me like this. I think many people have had to deal with that. How is the best way to provide information to them that you're there for them, but yet understand and respect the fact that they don't necessarily want to be seen at that moment?
Well, if somebody really doesn't want anybody there and doesn't want to be seen, then that's their choice. We all have our choice on how to handle our dying time. But I think it's important to indicate to that person that you really want to be there, that you wish that if they change their mind, you're certainly willing to be there, and that you'll miss them, and that you miss them now, and you want to spend this time with them, even though we know that it's a difficult time. Just to let them know that, to let them know that your choice is to be there, and even though that this time is a difficult one. But if the person continues to say, I don't want anybody to come, I don't want visitors, people have a right to have the circumstances that they wish.
Yeah, I know. I think that's one of those difficult things between, you know, you're respecting their word, but at the same time, if, you know, your gut is telling you that you know, that either that you want to be there, or that maybe they, you know, they would gain some benefit from it. Yeah, I just think, yeah, it's one of those difficult situations in any sense.
It is a difficult situation, and you have the feeling that they're making a mistake. And then we have to ask ourselves, do people have a right to make mistakes in their lives? God knows we all do.
Yeah.
So perhaps it is a mistake, and perhaps we could handle it better. But if what the person wants is to be alone during this rough period, then they have a right to make that choice. It's just important to let them know that you are willing to be there and would love to share this period with them.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I got from the book, and as I was reading it, I was thinking about how when I was younger, was pretty clueless, you know, in regards to any of this. And, you know, what do you see as your, I guess, you know, your audience for the book? Because as I was reading it, I was thinking, I really wish that I would have had something like this, maybe in high school or something, to where I would have understood a lot of these things better. Is there any chance that there's something like this, that we could get it to where they would start bringing it into schools?
Well, it's interesting. That suggestion has been made a number of times about getting it into schools and getting it to young people. I'm extremely grateful for the huge response nationally to the book. I mean, it's been much greater than anything I would have anticipated. And one of the groups are people who are younger. In essence, the book is a book about relationships. I particularly talk about relationships at the end of life, but it really is the secret of the book is it's about relationships in general, and all of us can use whatever help we can get in improving our relationships, because especially when we're younger, we have no experience with all of this. This is something that's unfamiliar to us, how to care for somebody who we love, who's in their dying time, who's at the end of life. And it would be so useful to people to just have the guidance necessary to handle the situation with greater peace.
You know, and again, so referring back to the book, one of the things that I think makes the book very unique is you go into exercises. So it's not only the fact of talking about it. So this isn't just a lecture. There's actually exercises that people can do. Can you share a couple of the exercises with us? For instance, speaking from the heart about bad news.
Well, you know, the thing about the speaking from the heart is that it's based on an understanding of what the other person is going through. And there's an exercise called a death personalization exercise, which is a long-winded way of saying, imagine yourself in their situation. Imagine yourself going through the very same things. You're in the bed. Doctors and nurses are coming in to talk to you about this and that, about treatments and about the illness. Your loved ones are coming from time to time, hopefully often enough. Imagine yourself in the same situation. What would you want people to be saying to you? What would you want people to be saying to you during this time? How would you want them to be with you? As you go through that exercise, you realize, my goodness, what I would want from myself is probably what they want from me.
Mm-hmm.
Building empathy for the other person, so you know what to say. You know how to speak from the heart.
I think that's a great point. Now, you also have about where you say create a mental movie, and you have an exercise for that that I thought was very interesting. Share a little bit about that.
Sure. You know, the thing about mental movies is that we can create in our minds a good depiction of what is likely to happen. And I ask people to make mental movies, not only the way we talk about it in the book, but when I'm with people, I actually will say, make a mental movie of your next visit to your loved one. Think about it in advance. Rehearse it the way actors rehearse before a performance. And rehearse in your mind, make a mental movie of what you're going to say and how they're going to look and how you're going to feel. Rehearse in advance. So it turns out that the brain and central nervous system don't know the difference between a deeply rehearsed image and the actual physical event. That's what athletes have discovered. That's why they do mental rehearsal so much.
Mm-hmm.
We can mentally rehearse what it'll be like to be with our loved one. We can do it in advance, so it's not so strange and we're not caught off guard so much. We can create that mental movie in advance the way athletes rehearse, like at the Olympic Games right now, that going on right now. Those athletes rehearse in their mm-hmm. minds over and over again their event. Well, we can rehearse our situation over and over again so that when we go in the room and we see our loved ones, we will have actually, in a sense, been there before. We will have rehearsed it before, and so it won't seem so strange.
Now, that makes perfect sense from the standpoint of being a gift for the dying person. How taxing is that on the person who's now doing the rehearsing? Because essentially, we're now doing something that may be very difficult for us to be able to see our loved one in this situation. We're now going through that now multiple times. How do we keep that from becoming really taxing on us?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. It turns out that it reduces anxiety. That
wow.
the rehearsal reduces the anxiety of the actual experience. So it's not that the rehearsal increases the anxiety and becomes a burden. The rehearsal actually minimizes what the burden is likely to be for that person when they actually go in the room and see their loved one. So rather than it being a negative, it turns out to be a positive.
Wow, that's great. Didn't think of it that way.
Yeah,
it's
important to recognize that, when people rehearse, when athletes rehearse, when entertainers rehearse, they're actually making themselves more familiar with the situation, and hence their anxiety level goes down.
Makes perfect sense. And one of the things that I thought was incredibly powerful is that you have an exercise for the golden light visualization. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a way of of creating a situation that is suffused with peace. That can you imagine yourself, and I won't go through the whole exercise, but I will say that, can you imagine a situation where there's a golden light that goes from you to the other person, that connects you in the spirit of love and affection, that you know that with them you create this essentially a glow of comfort that allows you to be with them with greater equanimity, peace, resilience, that you're in a situation in which you look forward to making memories with them and lessening regrets, and you're really creating a milieu, a circumstance that is best characterized by peace, by the word peace. So that golden glow is going to hold both of you. It's a way of taking the rough edges off the situation and allowing you to enter into a difficult situation with the knowledge that you will be able to handle it well.
Yeah, I know. And as I read it, I just thought that's so beautiful. Now we have another question coming in. This one comes in and it reads, I am a nursing administrator in a large LA hospital. Our nursing staff deal with dying patients and the aftermath on a regular basis, which has a considerable impact on their work and their personal life. Have you been involved in working with nurses? And it says, last, I would love to add your book to our recommended reading list if you believe our staff would benefit from it. And this is from Nadia in California.
Well, what I would say to Nadia is some of my earliest work and for many years was with nurses who have a tremendous amount of responsibility for caring for people at the end of life. Nurses are often the front line. Mm-hmm. And while the docs visit from time to time, the nurses are there much more frequently. And yes, I've had a lot of experience with nurses. And you see nurses go through grief process that's not acknowledged. Or even when it's acknowledged, often there's no situation that can help them deal with multiple griefs. Not only one person dying, like it would be in a family, but multiple deaths over and over again. And mm-hmm. Who cares for the nurses? Who cares for the caregiver? I think it's awfully important that that this kind of information, the kind of information that I write about in Life's Last Gift, is made available to nurses too. I wrote the book not only for family members. I wrote the book for health professionals and volunteers who care for dying people and who would love to have a trustworthy resource to use in their own daily life, in their own work, and to have something that they could hand to family members and friends. I have a lot to say about nurses because nurses are some of the real heroes of this situation. They don't think of themselves as heroes, I know that, but they're often the most heroic of all people because they're at the front line doing some of the most challenging work.
Well, yeah, I couldn't agree more on that. Now, share with us a little bit about, you know, the Shanti Project, because I know that, you know, obviously you're dealing with AIDS patients, you know, and cancer patients. So you're seeing people at, you know, in their last days quite frequently. So share a little bit about the project, and is there anything that's out there that is bringing additional hope to being able to allow these people to live longer?
Well, you know, I think that the thing I would say about Shanti Project is that we're in our 43rd year, and running a nonprofit for 43 years is in this climate is a challenging thing. But we've been doing this work originally with cancer patients, and then with people with HIV/AIDS, and now with people with cancer and others with HIV/AIDS. And we've done so on a volunteer basis, as well as having paid care navigators, people who take people through the healthcare system and help them navigate the whole situation. It's been a model for hundreds and hundreds of other community-based programs. Shanti was the first HIV/AIDS community-based program in the country because we already existed as a cancer project, and we switched our mission to AIDS, and we've been doing this work for a very long time. Now people with AIDS, many of them, live long lives with essentially a chronic illness, but they still need the support and still need the assistance. And if people want more information about Shanti, they can find it on my website, the website you mentioned earlier, charlesgarfield.com.
Thank you. That was the next thing I was going to say, is that if anybody out there, if you would like to get involved, or if you would like to make a donation or whatever, again, it's an incredible project, been around a long time, and it's helping a lot of people. So, anybody out there, feel free to get involved. So, Charles, we're just about running out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to share? First of all, I want to acknowledge you as someone who has dedicated their life to helping others, and helping others at a time that, you know, a lot of people wouldn't choose, you know, to be there for that. And I think you've just done an incredible service to everybody that you touch. So again, I want to acknowledge you and thank you for everything you do.
Well, thank you for the kind words. I really appreciate it. I don't know any other way to live a life. You know, I suppose that you can make all sorts of choices that are good choices in life, but I made this one. And if you would ask, and I know you'll appreciate this because I know it's important to you from what you've said, that if you ask what the value is that really got me motivated and keeps me motivated, it's kindness.
Mm-hmm.
Kindness is the basic value. Interestingly enough, that people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And if you can demonstrate that caring, that kindness to other human beings, not only at the end of life, but in life in general, then things will go a lot more smoothly in your daily relationships.
Well, I couldn't agree more. So again, thank you so much for being on with us, and for everybody out there, again, to get more information, go to charlesgarfield.com. And again, so for everybody out there, be sure that you're with us again next week, and put it on your calendar and tune in next Monday when our guest will be Al Killeen. And he is the author of Soul Experience, The Fourth Level of Identity. And I'm telling you, you won't want to miss this one, because Al has been on the show numerous times, and he's always leaves me and many other listeners who let me know afterwards feeling incredibly optimistic and joyful. So, and for those of you out there, please visit our archives of past shows. You can do that at answersforthefamily.com, or just subscribe to the show through iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or Vimeo, and they'll send it to you automatically. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people, and we so greatly appreciate it. And the next time that you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us and spread the word. So for everybody out there, be good human beings, be kind to each other, and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.